Welcome to the House of Brick Partner podcast. I'm Bob Lindquist. Today we have here with us some special guests, my colleague and executive consultant, Dave Welch from House of Brick. Dave, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
Also have one of our very important partners from Tactical Law Group, Pam Fulmer. Pam, appreciate you joining.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, for our discussion today, we're going to touch on, and we touch on this a lot when we're talking to our clients, particularly around Oracle audits. Sometimes it gets into the deep aspects of how do you license it, how do you not license it. But what I've seen now going 8 years at House of Brick, I've had many clients who just aren't aware about what they should do with an audit, or more importantly, how should they be prepared for an Oracle audit. So Dave, I know you have some good perspective since we've teamed on these sorts of things. What would you say is an Oracle audit from your technologist perspective?
Well, the software vendors obviously have the right to validate their licensees' use of their software. But there are some vendors, and Oracle seems to lead the pack, that try to take these audits and do far more than just validate appropriate use of software. They turn them into revenue generating events, and there can be some integrity issues associated with that. So these audits become an exercise in self-protection to make sure that the client's rights are not being violated, and that any compliance gaps that there may be, if any, don't turn into exorbitant amounts that have no actual merit.
Okay. So what I heard is, especially, and I've seen this as well, that the audit may be more of a sales activity than an actual, I'm here to help you.
Unfortunately, that's the case very often with Oracle audits.
Pam, from a legal perspective, Dave touched on it, but contractually, are customers obligated to do an Oracle audit?
Yes, they are. So, you know, unless they have some wildly differing contract, then all the Oracle licenses that I've seen have an audit clause. And basically, those provide that upon 45 days notice, you have to, you know, participate in the audit. And so that is a contractual right that Oracle has. One thing that I always find very interesting when I get involved in these is that oftentimes the clients, when I say, can you send me your Oracle license agreement, they actually don't have it at their fingertips. Sometimes they don't even have it. And so that is actually, you know, an issue, because the contract is your touchstone. And your rights and your obligations are in that document. So everybody should, you know, pull out that license agreement and know what it says. And they should know that well before they actually get an audit notice letter, especially if they want to, you know, get through the audit relatively unscathed. So as I said, Oracle has a contractual right to audit its customers. But the license agreement also provides the customer with contractual rights. You get that 45-day notice period that I mentioned. And also, the audit can unreasonably interfere with your normal business operations. And so that's really an important aspect to keep in mind. And we're going to go into some of these issues in a little bit more detail. But the key thing that you have to always keep in mind with regard to these audits is that Oracle is allowed to audit your use of their software, okay? Oracle isn't allowed to just go freewheeling through your IT environment looking at things that aren't related to use. So it should always come back to that issue, your use of Oracle software.
Right, and so what I'm hearing you say is many clients may not be well organized or understand perhaps even what's contractual or non-contractual. Can you kind of, you know, highlight what they may need to share? It might be a gray area, but what are the contractual things? And Dave, maybe you can talk on the non-contractual.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are a lot of contractual things. And like I said, you know, the big thing is that they're allowed to audit your use of software. And so, you know, they very methodically kind of go through that, but they often ask for And it's the Oracle LMS, which is the license management. Now they're called, I think, Glass, that actually conducts the audit. But they ask things oftentimes that are not really based in the contract. And so, you know, having someone that's familiar with really what you're obligated to do and what you're not obligated to do is important. And a huge part of that, you know, besides just looking at the legal contract, is actually what technical folks like House of Brick does. Because, you know, as a lawyer, sometimes if I would see an information request, it would be, you know, wrapped up in technical language, and I might not really understand what that, you know, is getting to. So it's sometimes when I talk to my technical experts like Dave and others and House of Brick, where, you know, I actually am able to be enlightened as to whether or not there is a demand for information that actually relates to the use of the software,
right,
or whether it's a situation where it's extra contractual and it doesn't.
Well, let me ask you this, and I was going to bring it up later, but let me do this as a follow-on. Should whoever's responsible for the Oracle audit, should they bring in other parts of the organization? Should they involve their inside counsel, Pam? Should they involve procurement? You know, what groups should or shouldn't be involved? And then Dave, I'll come back to you on the other side.
Right. Well, I think that they should definitely involve their legal counsel. And procurement is often involved, especially in larger organizations. But, you know, what I see all too much is that the IT department doesn't understand necessarily that this is something that could result in multi-million dollar exposure for the company. And they actually embark on the audit, and they actually have not consulted with their internal legal counsel. And I think that, you know, that can be very problematic. And what happens, and I know my clients in the legal departments are sometimes frustrated, because often this will land on their desk when it's an emergency and, you know, Oracle or some other vendor has come up with some huge multi-million dollar alleged compliance gap that, you know, right, has the company in an uproar. So if you have in-house legal counsel, you should definitely, you know, bring them in. You should also consider, you know, hiring outside counsel and, you know, outside counsel with their technical experts. And, you know, I think that is really important, you know, to be able to address and sometimes respond favorably and adequately, you know, with these audits. But, you know, one issue that we do have, even if you bring in your inside counsel, if you don't hire outside counsel, there may be an issue where, God forbid, if this would end up in litigation, a judge down the road might believe that the inside counsel was not rendering legal advice, but was rendering business advice. And business advice is not subject to the attorney-client privilege. So that's right, another reason to maybe get that belt and suspenders and consider bringing in folks like Tactical Law, House of Brick, people that deal with this literally, you know, every day and really understand the audit playbook that's played by these various software publishers.
If I can follow up on that just for a moment,
please,
too. And that is, Pam, you mentioned technicians potentially oversharing before internal legal counsel even gets involved, and then there's a big mess. Tactical Law Group and House of Brick can always excise such overshares, but it just takes a lot less distraction from the organization's revenue generating projects that they all have backlogs of. It takes a lot less consulting time to avoid those shares than it does to overshare and then have to excise that from an audit.
That's a great point, Dave.
And one of the things that occurs to me as I was listening is, Dave, we've said since I've been at House of Brick that we have options. And, you know, full transparency, Tactical Law Group being one of our most important partners here at House of Brick, we engage almost every day, every week, every month working with clients, but sometimes those clients don't know options. So back to maybe some of the non-contractual as it relates, say, virtualization and cloud, right? What do Oracle customers need to share about their architecture if they're virtualizing, if they're doing cloud? You know, what, where are they contractually obligated to share, or what don't they have to share?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, non-contractual. And the summary answer is share nothing that's not obligated contractually. The majority of the asks that Oracle makes during an audit are information that Oracle has no contractual right to whatsoever. And people listen to these questions, whether it's written or whether it's in meetings or calls. And the questions are articulated so well, and they seem so reasonable. So the temptation is to answer all the questions, not understanding that you're doing significant oversharing and putting your organization at risk of having supposed liabilities that really don't exist at all. So rather than get into the specifics here of what to share and what not to share, just the concept behind the need to get help with this is the information that's being shared truly necessary to validate the client's use of the Oracle programs? Or is it sales data? Answering right. that question won't give you the proper answer in every single case with every single ask, but it will take you far. You also asked about
if you have a follow-up on that. Right? Does Oracle have like assertions around how you need to license if you're running on a technology like VMware vSphere, or if you're moving to a cloud like AWS or Azure?
Yeah, since 2007, Oracle has been misrepresenting the terms of executed contracts to its clients. And that misrepresentation is nowhere more prominent than clients that are running Oracle programs on Hyper-V, Microsoft Hyper-V, or VMware vSphere. And the Oracle has been very quiet about making that claim publicly. They avoided very, very much making that claim publicly, but they would make it one client at a time, behind the bush and behind closed doors. And then, Pam, you might want to comment on the Chad Russell statement that was disclosed through the Mars filing associated with that whole VMware issue.
Sure. So VMware is a big issue that we see coming up all the time in these audits. And, people basically, and Oracle has this down pat, okay? They come blazing in and they present you with a document. Again, it's not in your contract, which is another reason that you should be looking at your contract. But they present you with a document that looks all official. And they say, basically, what you're doing in your environment is not a recognized form of partitioning, hard partitioning. And therefore, you owe us fill in the blank of how many millions of dollars. And what they're relying on there is a non-contractual policy, not your contract. And so it's really amazing the number of people that fall for that and will accept that and actually right. pay big money. We don't do that. We make sure that, if there's a meritorious finding, that's one thing. But, non-contractual policies of Oracle that aren't binding, contractual provisions, that is something that, we don't accept. And that's how we... one of the ways we save our clients a lot of money.
Yeah, right. And VMware right. and Hyper-V, Oracle claims that because you could move, because the software is designed for the capability of live migration, therefore, because you could move the workload to these other servers, physical servers, right. it is as good as done. Therefore, you have to pay for an eventuality, a licensing eventuality that may never occur. Right. There's just no merit to that.
And again,
well, and one of your colleagues, while we're talking, I recall after being here a year or two, one of your colleagues, Dave, put together a comic called The Oracle Parking Garage. And we'll include that in the posting of this podcast. But I think that illustrates a lot of what Oracle customers see when Oracle is asserting that you got to pay for wherever you're running VMware.
Right.
That brings us to the end of episode 1 on Oracle audits. Please check back soon for the next episode of our ongoing discussion on this important topic. Thanks for listening.